Well, from about 1990 to 2005, there was a group of scholars on the theological left called the Jesus Seminar, and they were the darlings of the mainstream media. They were, whenever you'd see a special program, a documentary, they were interviewing primarily the Jesus Seminar fellows. At that time, there were a lot of different articles, journals, I'm trying to think of the different ones out there, but they'd come out every Easter and Christmas with a new article about Jesus, what scholars have now discovered about the real Jesus. Every Christmas and Easter, this would come out, and it was all these skeptical views. Again, these were just scholars on the theological left and called the Jesus Seminar. Shortly after 2005, even the mainstream media recognized that their views were very out of step with where mainstream scholarship is today, and they stopped interviewing them as much. The group still exists today, but they don't have but a small fraction of the influence they used to. I've debated three of the fellows from the Jesus Seminar, John Dominic Crossan, Dennis McDonald, and Stephen Patterson. All three of them, in my conversations with them, they deny that a supreme being, a creator of the universe, exists. They deny that Jesus rose from the dead. They deny an afterlife in any meaningful sense. And yet all three refer to themselves as Christians. In 2009, I debated Stephen Patterson at Florida State University. About 900 people showed up for that debate. And we debated on the resurrection of Jesus. It was the week prior to Easter. And so I gave this guy right before the debate, a friend of mine who was the director for the Baptist Collegiate Ministry. So in the state of Florida, they had all these different Baptist Collegiate Ministries, campus ministries on various, you know, lots of different college campuses throughout Florida. And he was the director over all of that. And he came up and he said hi to me. And he said, I heard you were going to be here, so I wanted to come and see you debate tonight. So in my opening statement, I argued a historical case for the resurrection of Jesus. And then Stephen got up in his opening statement, and he started to give some arguments against the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. And he says, look, one of the things he says, look, Mike can give all this historical evidence for it, but when we really come down to it, Mike, I just don't see these things like resurrections happening today. I don't see miracles happening today, and I got to go with my experience. And so in my rebuttal, my first rebuttal, I got up and I said, now, Steve says he doesn't see miracles and resurrections happening today. Miracles don't happen today, and so that would show that they probably didn't happen in the past. I said, well, you know, I know a guy who back in June of 1987, he was involved in a car accident, a really bad one. He was driving from Alabama to Florida, and he had a late night, and he was driving throughout the night, and he just got too tired to drive. And so he pulled over to the side of the road, put his seat back, and went to sleep. But there was a drunk driver speeding down the highway. He didn't see his car and slammed right into the back of it. And he put this guy in the hospital, and he was in a coma for several weeks. The 4th of July came around, and his church got together for a 4th of July picnic. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they prayed for this guy, whose name is Loy Reed. Loy Reed. And they prayed for him. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and miles away at the hospital at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Loy came out of his coma. And everyone that was in the room with Loy had been in their comas from 1 to 6 months. And before midnight, every one of them came out of their coma. So I said, in fact, it's really interesting. Before tonight's debate, my friend Loy Reed came up to greet me. He's the director of the Baptist Collegiate Ministries here in Florida. Loy is here. Loy, would you stand up and wave? And he was right in the center in the very back, and he stood up and waved, and 900 people turned around and saw him. And I said, see, Steve, miracles happen today, and if they happen today, that increases the probability that they happened in the past. It's pretty cool how God can work through some things. Well, Let's just do a quick review. I don't know what happens with this, why we have these, why it just goes through all of these things. I mean, I put this on the right slide, and it just like, okay, well, Mike, you're taking too long. Let's speed this up, you know? Okay, here we go. So let's just do a quick recap of where we have come in these past 6 weeks. So remember, if there's one thing you take away from this, what is it? Christ rose from the dead, and therefore Christianity is true. And there is no objection that could come up that would change that. Well, but Mike, you know, I know you're talking about gospel differences, and skeptics say there are errors, contradictions in the gospels. Okay, well, let's just say that everything I'm presenting over all these weeks is wrong. It's all wrong, okay? And let's just say that there are errors and contradictions in the gospels. Remember, the gospels are written years after the resurrection of Jesus. So if Jesus truly rose from the dead, Christianity was true when he rose from the dead. And it was true in all those years up to when the first gospel and the other gospels were written. So how could an error in any of the gospels negate the truth of the resurrection of Jesus when it happened years, decades before any of the gospels were written? It wouldn't. So, well, what about Mike? What if Genesis is wrong? What if God? What if he created through evolutionary processes? Well, if Jesus rose from the dead, is Christianity still true? Yeah, of course it is. But Mike, what if some of the books, what if we talk about the formation of the biblical canon, who chose the books to be included in the Bible? What if over the years they got some of it wrong and there are some literature in the New Testament that should not be there? If Jesus rose from the dead, is Christianity still true? Absolutely. So the point I'm trying to make here, let me go one more. Let's just say that some of the Old Testament scripture, when it talks about God saying, go and kill the men, women, and children, and all the animals, you know, wipe them out. Let's just suppose that all the answers that Christians have provided to explain that are false. And let's just say that that is just political propaganda by the ancient Israelites meant to justify the acts of a brutal king. Israelite king. If Jesus rose from the dead, is Christianity still true? Yes. And that's the one thing I want you, if anything, take away from this, because there are no objections out there provided by skeptics that debunk Christianity if Jesus rose from the dead. And so the resurrection of Jesus is key. So even if everything I'm teaching in these 11 weeks is false, this is true. Christianity is true because Jesus rose from the dead. Please remember that. Now, we've talked about how there's a literary dependence between the Gospels, that Matthew and Luke most likely used Mark as their primary source and supplemented it with other eyewitness testimony. Luke was not an eyewitness, but he said he interviewed the eyewitnesses and those who knew the eyewitnesses. Matthew would have been an eyewitness, so he could have provided additional testimony, but there's decent evidence to suggest that Matthew and Luke used Mark as their primary source and supplemented it. We've also noticed that the Gospels are ancient biographies. That's the genre in which they were written. They focus on the life of Jesus. They avoid allegory. They fall within the average length of an ancient biography. And there's little to no time spent on Jesus' childhood, which would have been, we see throughout other ancient biographies, that is the way things worked. They just didn't spend much time on the childhood. They just had the initial, like, talking about the lineage of the person, and then bam, right into the inauguration of their public life. We saw a few weeks ago that there's evidence that the ancients used secretaries to help them compose the literature. We saw that Cicero, one of the most highly educated Roman intellectuals, used a secretary named Tiro, who did a whole lot more than take dictation. He did major editing to Cicero's writings. we saw that at least in three of Paul's letters, and probably a minimum of four, that Paul used secretaries, actually a minimum of five, one of which is his letter to the church at Rome. And in chapter 16, verse 22, the secretary that he used even provides his own name. He says, "I, Tertius, who wrote this letter, greet you in the Lord." And given the literary beauty and sophistication of Romans compared to some of other Paul's letters, it is highly likely, it is far more probable than not, that Tertius did a whole lot more in the composition of Romans than merely take dictation. So if that's the case with Paul's letters and with Cicero, we would certainly anticipate that the gospel authors, Matthew, Mark, John, and perhaps even Luke, would have used a secretary to help compose their biographies of Jesus. Then we saw that the Gospels are, they have elements of portrait in them. And just as a portrait, we're not going to assess a portrait according to precise accuracy, like photographic accuracy. We're going to, you got Tom in here, he was showing me some of his photographs before this. It's like amazing. And Jerry Black, I've seen some of his photographs. They're just amazing photographers. Well, when you are taking a photograph, you're getting an exact representation of that small thing that's going on. But if, let's say, Tom takes and does some post-editing on that to augment the colors or something like that, it brings out an emphasis that's there. It's not inaccurate as long as we recognize that it's done for beauty, it's done to make a point, to draw emphasis to something. It's fine within that genre as long as we understand that that is standard for what they're doing. Same thing with a portrait. The battle behind being portrayed here with George Washington wasn't actually going on when he was having this portrait painted of him, but it is to make a point, accurate points, but not in a photographic sense. Ancient biographies and histories, but especially biographies, would have some elements of portrait in them. There was a degree of flexibility that was afforded the biographer that they could play a little with the details, you might say, in order to make their point more clearly, strongly, to make a theological point behind it, all different kinds of reasons that they might do that. And now, the Gospels aren't total portraits. They are mainly photographs with some portrait elements in it. And we need to understand that in order to interpret them properly. Reading the Gospels in view of their biographical nature can shed additional light on biblical texts that previously eluded us. We saw this in the case of the deity of Christ in Mark, how he's illuminating Jesus' character through his words and deeds in most chapters. Provides insights pertaining to the degree of accuracy we should expect in the Gospels. We saw that Matthew gives us an artistic rendition of Jesus' genealogy. Remember gematria, three sets of 14, and you assign a numerical value to letters. There are three letters in the name David or Dawid, and that ends up comes out to the number 14. And so Matthew is saying three times, 14, 14, 14, to provide us with an artistic representation of Jesus as the son of David, the Messiah. We also saw that Matthew repositioned Jesus's place, location on the mount instead of on the plain. As Luke has it, he's at the top of the mount and probably does that to suggest that Jesus is a type of new Moses. As Moses received God's law at the top of the mount, Jesus is the interpreter of that law. And Matthew will go on to have Jesus saying, "You have heard that it was said, the ancients were told, thou shalt not kill. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother," etc. "You have heard it was said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So these portrait elements are involved. The Gospels are literary portraits of Jesus, and so therefore, because Scripture is divinely inspired, this is what divinely inspired Scripture looks like. Students in their mid-teens, we saw this last week, learn techniques for writing using compositional textbooks, and they would use things for paraphrasing. Aelius Theon in the first century asserted that the techniques learned in the compositional textbooks are the foundation for every form of literature, and that all ancient writers, poets, orators, and historians alike used these techniques for paraphrasing their own writings and those of others. We observed a few examples in the Greco-Roman literature and in the Gospels where the use of one or more compositional devices was likely responsible for creating differences. So that brings us up to date now with this week. And what I want to do before we get into some more compositional devices and talk about Plutarch, I want to spend just a few moments with you to talk about the intersection between the Roman culture and what was going on with Christianity in the first century. We could call it the intersection between Rome and Jerusalem. Now, there's a lot, and I put that together, so I'm just going to read to you what I put together for a few minutes here. For me, the first century BC and the first century AD are the two most fascinating centuries in human history. As a Christian, the incarnation, life, death, resurrection of Jesus, the inception of the Christian church, and the composition of much, if not all, of the New Testament literature occurred in the first century AD. In the first century BC, there are dramatic events that led the Roman Republic to transition to an empire that are the basis of movies, television drama series, and documentaries. Less than 80 years after the Jews won their freedom from the Seleucid Empire, a victory celebrated at Hanukkah, their queen died, leaving two sons, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II, fighting to, by the way, if you have any grandchildren, your children are pregnant, your daughter's pregnant, or daughter-in-law's pregnant, and they're going to have a son, and they're thinking of names, just Hyrcanus, Aristobulus, you know, just keep them in mind. They were fighting to possess her throne. In 63 BC, the matter was brought before the Roman general Pompey when he came to Damascus. Pompey ended up siding with Hyrcanus, who in turn surrendered Jerusalem to him. In 54 BC, Crassus, the Roman general who had defeated Spartacus 17 years earlier, plundered the treasury in the Jerusalem temple. Cassius, one of the conspirators who would later kill Julius Caesar, crushed an insurrection of the Jews in Judea in 52 BC. 3 years later, in January 49 BC, Caesar crosses the Rubicon and civil war ensued until Caesar defeated Pompey at Pharsalus in August 48 BC. Caesar was assassinated 19 years later on the Ides of March 44 BC. 2 years after that, Mark Antony and Caesar's nephew Octavian, whom Caesar had adopted and appointed heir, engaged and defeated the assassins Brutus and Cassius at Philippi in October 42 BC. This is where, a century later, the Apostle Paul would establish a church, and a letter written to that church is in our New Testament. The victor Antony went on to have an infamous relationship with Cleopatra. They had children who, as teens, were tutored by Nicolaus of Damascus. Nicolaus was also a mentor for Herod the Great, who had been appointed by Antony in 41 BC to be the Jewish tetrarch. And with Octavian, Antony arranged for him on the following year to be recognized by the Roman Senate as king of the Jews, a client king of Rome. Relations between Antony and Octavian became increasingly bitter until they met at the Battle of Actium on September 2nd, 31 BC. After Octavian defeated Antony, Herod met him and promised to be a friend to him with the same loyalty he had given Antony. For this gesture, Octavian confirmed Herod's position as king of the Jews. Herod built Masada, rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem, and would later order the killing of infants in Bethlehem. In 27 BC, the Roman Senate conferred several honors on Octavian, one of which was giving him the name Augustus, the name by which he is known in Luke chapter 2, verse 1. Now, it came about in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus to register all the world. In the year 8 BC, the Roman Senate named a month after Augustus that stands to this day. I'll bet you can guess which month that is. Herod the Great would go on to engage in actions that placed great strain on his standing with Augustus. When Herod died in 4 BC, Augustus intended to abolish the position king of the Jews and absorb the territory held by Herod to be under direct Roman rule henceforth. But Nicolaus intervened and convinced Augustus to allow Herod's son Archelaus to serve as his successor, according to the terms of Herod's will. However, he abolished the title King of the Jews and divided Herod's kingdom among his three surviving sons. So remember, by the time you get to Jesus, that title King of the Jews had been abolished. To Archelaus, he bestowed the lesser title Ethnarch and gave him Judea and Samaria. It was this Herod who was feared by Jesus' father, Joseph, who, being warned in a dream, avoided Archelaus in Judea and settled in Nazareth, Matthew chapter 2. Archelaus ruled so ruthlessly that Augustus removed him in the year 6 in order to avoid a revolt that was brewing. Judea and Samaria were then put directly under the rule of a Roman prefect. To Herod's other two sons, Philip and Antipas, Augustus bestowed the title of Tetrarch. Herod Philip received territories located east and northeast of the Sea of Galilee. When Philip died in the year 34, the territory he ruled was added to the Roman province of Syria. Herod Antipas received Galilee and Perea. This was the Herod who had taken the wife of his brother Philip, had beheaded John the Baptist, and to whom Pilate had sent Jesus. In the year 39, Emperor Caligula deposed and banished Antipas and replaced him with his Caligula's friend, Agrippa I, who was Antipas's nephew and brother-in-law. In the year 41, the Emperor Claudius, restored to Agrippa I all the territories his grandfather Herod the Great had possessed and bestowed on him the title King of Judea. It was this Herod who persecuted the church, executed James, the son of Zebedee, and arrested Peter. In the year 44, he died of an illness, his last public act being described by Luke in the book of Acts and by Josephus. Claudius was emperor when Agrippa I died. His son Agrippa II was with Claudius at the time. Because of his youth, Agrippa II was not allowed by Claudius to inherit his father's territories, given their importance to Rome. However, in the year 50, there was a kingdom of lesser importance to Rome and recently left vacant by the death of another Herod, Herod of Chalcis, who was married to Agrippa II's sister Bernice. Claudius gave this kingdom to Agrippa II. The Apostle Paul stood before this Agrippa and his sister Bernice when they visited the Roman governor Festus in Caesarea. We can begin to see how interconnected the world of Jesus and the New Testament authors was with the Greco-Roman world. Understanding both worlds can sometimes shed light that assists us when interpreting New Testament texts. Let's look at an example. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus speaks of adultery and lust and then says, "If your right eye makes you sin, rip it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of your body parts than for your entire body to be thrown into hell." And then he says the same thing about a person's right hand. Well, wow, that's pretty serious business, isn't it? But surely Jesus does not intend for us to take this literally. At least we hope not. But why not? Why are we not to take these words literally? I mean, after all, there's nothing in the text itself which would suggest to us in the 21st century that it should not be taken literally. Now, before you gouge out your eye or cut off your hand, let's take a look at what a Roman statesman and Stoic philosopher said in the same century. His name is Seneca, and he wrote the following in a letter to his friend Lucilius. Vice, Lucilius, is what I wish you to proceed against, without limit and without end. For it has neither limit nor end. If any vice rend your heart, cast it away from you. And if you cannot be rid of it in any other way, pluck out your heart also. Seneca is not actually encouraging Lucilius to kill himself, if that is what it takes to prevent an immoral or bad habit from controlling him. But he is emphasizing the importance of dealing with vice. Jesus is doing the same when he instructs those who struggle with lust to rip out their eye. Your eternal destiny is a very serious matter, so you should take your sanctification very seriously. This is an instance when we can say the text does not mean what it says. It means what it means. On occasion, interacting with Greco-Roman literature can shed interpretive light on texts whose meaning has remained elusive. In the previous week, we observed that those trained to write something as sophisticated as a biography learned various techniques for varying an existing account. To do so was both proper and expected. This is not at all to downplay the importance of recognizing that Jesus was a Jew who practiced mainly, or preached mainly, though by no means exclusively, to Jews. Who were the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes? What was their roles and beliefs? Understanding the cultural milieus of both Jewish and Greco-Roman worlds assist readers in interpreting the Gospels accurately. Since the Gospels are biographies of Jesus, or at minimum share much in common with the genre of ancient biography, with some of additional techniques employed by ancient biographers will assist us in reading the Gospels accurately. So let's spend some time now discussing an important biographer of that period and to which I referred last week. His name is Plutarch. And much of what we understand about the ancient world comes from Plutarch. He was born around the year 40 and died shortly after the year 120. He wrote over 60 biographies. They're called lives. Back then, they didn't call them biographies. They called them lives, like the life of Caesar, the life of Cicero, etc. He wrote over 60 lives, of which 58 have survived. And what's interesting, as we read through these, we find that Plutarch will tell the same story in several of the biographies, like when these figures intersect with one another. So if he's telling a biography of Julius Caesar, you're going to find stuff about Cicero, you're going to find stuff about Crassus and Pompey and Brutus. And so we look at how the same story is told in these different lives. And we find some interesting things. Plutarch never copies and pastes. He always paraphrases, just like he would have been taught. I found, in my research, 36 stories that are told in two or more times in 9 of Plutarch's lives. Characters who lived at the same time, for the most part, knew one another and participated in many of the same events. So seeing how Plutarch, looking carefully, how Plutarch varies the story can shed additional light on how ancient biographers wrote. And Plutarch is regarded to be the greatest ancient biographer. So we notice a number of what are called compositional devices that Plutarch used. And classicists like Christopher Pelling, the foremost Plutarch scholar in the world, who just a few years ago retired from Oxford, J.L. Moles, another prominent classicist who recently died, I think he died last year, they say that these kinds of compositional devices that I'm going to be mentioning were used by virtually all ancient biographers. Let's look at a few of them so we can just see what they were. One is compression. Compression is when an author knowingly portrays an event as though it had occurred over a shorter period of time. Displacement. Displacement is when an author knowingly removes an event from its original context and transplants it into another. Transferal is when an author knowingly attributes words or deeds to a person that he knew belonged to another. Conflation. An author combines elements from two or more events or people and narrates them as one. We see this a lot in modern movies and documentaries just for purposes of simplifying. Simplification. An author omits or alters details that may complicate the overall narrative or does so merely to abbreviate and communicate the main ideas. Literary spotlighting. It's when an author only mentions the person in focus while being aware that others were present. Now let's look at a few examples. This week and next week, we're going to look at examples of these in both Plutarch and the Gospels. Literary spotlighting. Now imagine this. You go to a theatrical play and you see a bunch of people, actors on stage, and all of a sudden the lights go down and a spotlight comes on and shines on a single person who breaks out in monologue or song. Well, you as the spectator know that other people are there, but the spotlight is on that single person. Literary spotlighting is when an author is aware that there are multiple people involved in an event, but shines their spotlight, their literary spotlight on that person. So he's only narrating one of those people being there and acting, but the author is aware that others are present. Let's give you an example from Plutarch. Now, in 63 BC, which, by the way, is the same year that Pompey took Jerusalem, you have in Rome a guy named Sergius Catilina. We call him Catiline. And he was a Roman senator. Back then, the way things worked, you didn't have a president, a one-person president like we have, and you didn't have a House and a Senate and a Supreme Court. What they had was a Senate, and then every year they would elect two consuls, and they would serve for 1 year. You had a primary consul. The other had pretty much equal authority, but so it wasn't like a president, vice president, but there was a dominant one who was consul. You only served for 1 year. You could run for consul again, but you had to wait 10 years to run again. Okay? But that could make an interesting scenario for our country, couldn't it? So Catiline had run against Cicero and lost in the year 62 BC. 63 BC, he ran for consul again and lost again to a guy named Catulus. There's another name for you, for your grandson, Catulus. So Catiline lost again. And so he said, well, if I can't win by election, I will take it by force. And so he forms this conspiracy. He gets a bunch of people to join him, and their plans are to kill all the Roman senators, to burn the city of Rome, and then he'll take over as dictator. Well, it's kind of found out because you have someone who's anonymous who delivers letters to Crassus, a guy named Crassus, who is the Roman general who defeated Spartacus. And Crassus has these letters that reveal Catiline's conspiracy. And so in Plutarch's Life of Cicero, his biography of Cicero, he narrates how Crassus and Metellus and Marcellus come and awaken Cicero at night and reveal the conspiracy that is about to take place, that Catiline is brewing. So that's how it's talked about in the Life of Cicero. But when Plutarch writes about the same event in his Life of Crassus, he shines his literary spotlight on Crassus, and he only mentions Crassus coming at night to give the news to Cicero. So this is the life of Crassus, so he's only mentioning Crassus. Now, the next morning, Plutarch narrates that Cicero gets up, he's consul that year, and he calls an emergency meeting of the Senate. So they get together, and Cicero passes out these letters that had been given to him to each of the senators and says, what are we to do? So again, this is 63 BC. So you've got a guy, Julius Caesar, who is not a huge name at this point. He's growing in his stature. Again, it's 63 BC. He doesn't cross the Rubicon until 49 BC. but he's becoming a major political player at this point. And he gets up and he says, look, I think what we should do is we should arrest the conspirators and put them in jail and confiscate their property. And then we go and we crush Catiline's insurrection, his rebellion, and then we will put these guys on trial. And the Senate says, well, that sounds pretty good. But then, according to Plutarch's Life of Cicero and Life of Caesar, a guy named Cato, I mentioned him last week, a man of great integrity, Cato and Catulus, who had just been elected the consul, but he'll take over on January 1st. This is November that we're talking about now. And they get up and they say, no, what we need to do is arrest these conspirators that we can get our hands on now and execute them. Let's put them to death, because if we don't do this now, there will be more who will join the rebellion. And so we've got to stamp this out now. So that's the way the story, and by the way, they win the day and they arrest the conspirators and put them to death that same day. That's the way the story Plutarch tells in his Life of Cicero and Caesar. But in Plutarch's Life of Cato, he shines a spotlight on Cato. So he only mentions Cato getting up and suggesting that they arrest these people today and put them to death today, immediately. So he has no need to mention Catulus. This is he's focusing on Cato and Cato's acts. So that's why he only mentions Cato. Let's see how spotlighting works in the Gospels. Now, you come to the resurrection narrative, and we find that when the women get up on Sunday morning, they go to the tomb, and in Matthew and Mark, there's a single angel there. At least that's all they mention. But in Luke and John, there are two angels. What's going on? Well, in my opinion, what's probably happening here is Mark and Matthew are shining their literary spotlight on the angel who is announcing that Jesus rose from the dead, and he's no longer there. And then what's interesting is right after that, you say, well, how many women actually went to the tomb? Well, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it mentions multiple women, whereas in John, it only mentions Mary Magdalene. It says early in the morning, John 20, verse 1, early in the morning while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene got up and went to the tomb. So is this literary spotlighting? I think so. And here's why. Because when she sees it empty, she runs back, finds Peter and the beloved disciple, and says, they have taken the Lord, and we don't know where they've laid him. Who's we? And then what's interesting, how many of the disciples run to the tomb? Well, in Luke says Peter got up and ran to the tomb and found it empty, but John's gospel says Peter and the beloved disciple got up and ran to the tomb and found it empty. What's going on here? I think you probably have some literary spotlighting. Why? Because in Luke 24:12, when it says Peter got up and ran to the tomb and found it as the women said, scroll down 12 verses to chapter 24, verse 24, and Jesus is talking to the Emmaus disciples at that point. And it says their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And so he's talking, why the long faces, guys? Well, are you the only one here in the Jerusalem area who hasn't heard what happened this weekend? You know, Jesus, we thought he was the Messiah, but our leading people among the Jews turned him over to the Romans on Friday and they crucified him. But our women folk went to the tomb this morning and said they saw angels that said he'd been raised from the dead. And then some of our own, plural, went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said. But Luke, just 12 verses earlier, you said just Peter. No, I didn't say just Peter. I only mentioned Peter because he's the lead apostle. I'm shining my spotlight on him. But I'm obviously aware that there were more there because I said 12 verses later, some of our own went to the tomb. But Luke, we don't do that today in the 21st century. So, you think that Matthew, Mark, and John and myself got together to try to figure out what you guys were going to do 2 millennia from now and write according to you? No, we're writing according to how people wrote in the first century. Transferal. Now, here, that's when you transfer the actions of a person or the words of a person to someone else. Now, Pompey, great Roman general, statesman, it's 53 BC, and Rome is in a state of great chaos. It's like there are riots around. There's a lot of political discourse. Serious, it sounds a lot like the U.S. today. And I mean, it's like on a state of possibly collapsing as a nation. Rome was. And I'm speaking of Rome. So they say, okay, look, we've got to take drastic measures here. So let's do this. Pompey is a level-headed guy. He's intelligent. People respect him. Let's allow him to go against our constitution of a republic, and let's let him serve almost like a dictator, but only for 1 year. And what Pompey says goes. So you don't need the Senate's approval. Pompey, you just make the laws and enforce them, and we will follow you for 1 year. So that takes place. They bicker over that for a little bit, and a few months into the year 52 BC, he takes over as the single ruler. Well, Pompey makes some good laws, but he proceeds to break one of those laws. That law that he broke was, he said, first he comes and he says, look, if you have a friend who's on trial for something, you can't go in and read a speech that praises this person lavishly, because it really has nothing to do with whether he committed the crime, and you'll only serve to bias the jury on this. But then when Pompey's friend Plancus is on, there's another name for you, Plancus. When Plancus is on trial, Pompey breaks his own rule, and here's how he does it. He's out of the country at that time, and so he crafts a lavish speech, and he gives it to an emissary. Oh, come on. How does that happen? So he crafts this speech, and gives it to this emissary who comes in and reads it at the trial. This is what it is said in Plutarch's Life of Cato. And the reason he mentions this in the Life of Cato is because Cato is a jurist. And Cato strongly objects, and he says, Pompey is breaking his own law by doing this. He objects so strenuously that he's booted off the jury. So that's why the story is told in the Life of Cato. But in Plutarch's Life of Pompey, what he does is he narrates Pompey himself going into the city and appearing before the jury and reading this. So he transfers it from the emissary to Pompey himself. He simplifies it in that sense. And we know that Pompey wouldn't have gone in the city because he was with his army at the time outside the city, and you weren't allowed to come in. Yep. Okay. Let's look at transferal in the Gospels. So there's the story of Jesus healing a centurion's servant. This story is told in both Matthew and in Luke. Now, what happens is the centurion has this servant who's really sick. And so he sends some Jewish elders to Jesus to request that Jesus come and heal him. And Jesus says, okay, let's do it. So they head toward the centurion's house. Well, the centurion gets word of this, and so he ends up sending some friends to Jesus and saying, oh, no, don't come to my house. I'm unworthy for you to be under my roof. But look, you're a man of authority just like me. And just like I say to my one soldier, do this, and they do it, and come and do this, and to a slave, go do this, and they do it. Look, all you have to do, Jesus, is say the word, and my servant will be healed. And Jesus praises the centurion for his faith and heals his servant without ever seeing the centurion or his servant. That's how Luke reports the story. But Matthew, who has a tendency to abbreviate, to simplify, he employs transferal. And so he has the centurion himself go to Jesus and make the request in person, please come heal my servant. Jesus says, well, let's go to your house. And that's when the centurion says, no, I'm unworthy for you to come to my house. I'm a man of authority, just like you. Just say the word and my servant will be healed. Jesus praises the centurion for his faith and heals the servant without ever seeing the servant. Here's another example in the Gospels. In Mark's Gospel, this is toward the end of Jesus' ministry, on both Gospels it is. And so they're walking along the road, they're headed back to Jerusalem, and they're arguing, the disciples are arguing with one another, which one of us is the greatest. So when they take a break, Jesus says to them, hey, what were you guys arguing about along the way? And they're quiet, they're embarrassed, they're quiet. And that's when Jesus makes a statement, if you want to be great, you've got to be servant of all. When that's Mark. When Matthew tells the same story, he just abbreviates and transfers, and he just has the apostles, the disciples, come right out and say, hey, Jesus, which one of us is the greatest? And that's when Jesus says, you know, if you want to be great, you got to be last. So he simplifies the account. He transfers the words rather than Jesus asking the question, what were you arguing about? The disciples just come right out and say, hey, which one of us is the greatest? Here's another one. Jesus' baptism. It's reported in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And when Jesus comes out of the water in Mark and in Luke, God's voice says, you are my beloved son. In you, I am well pleased. When Matthew reports it, God's voice says, this is my beloved son. In him, I am well pleased. Well, you can see there's a slight difference here. What is it? Well, in Mark and Luke, God is addressing Jesus directly, whereas in Matthew, he's directing the crowd. Well, why would he do this? Well, we can only guess, but probably Matthew has changed it because he wants to make God addressing the witnesses to Jesus' baptism, more or less in this case, the readers of his gospel, so that God is addressing the readers and making it a little more personable. So there is transferal there. Now, why is this important, what we have discussed today? We're going to look at some others next week, but why is what we've been discussing so far this week important? Well, some have mistakenly identified gospel differences as errors when the differences are actually intentional and result from the author's use of one or more compositional devices. When a compositional device is responsible for a difference, attempting to harmonize the difference, as some have done by saying, well, the centurion first sent some Jewish elders and then sent some friends and then said, oh, heck, I'm just going to go anyway, and try to harmonize. Well, if you're attempting to harmonize the difference, it can take one down the wrong path and yield an incorrect understanding of why the difference is present. So let's summarize. Plutarch is regarded as the greatest biographer in antiquity. With Plutarch, we can assess how the same author, using the same sources, reporting the same event in biographies of different people. Plutarch never copies and pastes. He intentionally reworks a narrative using a variety of compositional devices. Since the Gospels are also ancient biographies, we should anticipate their authors using similar compositional devices. And reading the Gospels in view of the compositional devices used by Plutarch yields wonderful fruit related to how many of the Gospel differences came into being. Now, going to challenge you on a few things here for further thought. I want to look at the example about when Jesus sends out his disciples and he's talking about staffs and sandals. Let's look at what the Gospels report. Here's what Matthew says. Jesus says, acquire no gold or silver or copper for your belts, no bag for your journey, no, not two tunics, nor sandals, nor a staff. Here's what Luke says. And he said to them, take nothing for your journey, no staff, no bag, no bread, no money, and do not have two tunics. And here's what Mark says. He charged them to take nothing for their journey except only a staff. No bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not put on two tunics. Let's summarize. So you can see what the difference is. So did Jesus tell him to take sandals and a staff or not to take sandals and a staff? Anybody, I mean, we haven't talked about this, but anyone want to take a shot at what might be going on here? Yes, ma'am.
Could he just be making a point of, I don't want you to take a lot with you. Trust me, and there's a difference of what you take, whatever. The point is, don't take a lot of stuff, trust God.
Whew. Yes, ma'am. Way to go. You got it. That's what I think is going on here, too. I think that had we actually been traveling with Jesus, it would have been like we read in Mark. But I think just like you say, that in Matthew and Luke, they're just wanting to make the point more clearly. And the point is trust God for everything. Trust him for everything. You don't have to take anything with you. Just trust him for everything, which is what Jesus was saying to them. But, you know, for practical purposes, yeah, you can take sandals. It's going to be hard to travel if you're barefoot, right? And you can take a staff for protection against animals, but trust God for everything. So I think you're spot on with what was going on there. Here's another one. You know the story of Legion, right? About the demon-possessed guy. So let's look at Mark. When Jesus stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. In Luke, when Jesus had stepped out on a land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. Matthew. And when he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs. Anybody want to guess, take a shot at what's going on here? Spotlighting. I think probably spotlighting's going on. That it's the demon who is talking. Legion, for we are many. Mark and in Luke, Mark is shining his spotlight and Luke is just repeating Mark on the matter. I think that's probably what is going on. Of course, these are all just guesses, right? We'd like to be able to go back and to interview Matthew and say, hey, what's going on here? But I think this is probably what he would say. How about blind Bartimaeus? All right, let's look at what the Gospels say there. Mark, and they came to Jericho. And as Jesus was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. So it's as they were leaving Jericho, right, that they meet the blind Bartimaeus. Luke, and as he approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging, and Jesus calls him and heals him. Matthew, and as they left Jericho, a great crowd followed him, and behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. What do you think's going on?
More spotlighting.
Yeah, it could be spotlighting. They're just... some scholars, New Testament scholars, have suggested that there were two, but there's Mark mentions blind Bartimaeus by name because they knew Bartimaeus. Someone in the congregation there would have known Bartimaeus, and so that's why they mention him. Or maybe Bartimaeus was his source for this, so he actually knew the person. That's possible. But it could be that there's spotlighting that is going on here. Craig Keener, another New Testament scholar, he's an evangelical, he suggested that Matthew doesn't report as many healings as some of the other Gospels do. And so he's aware that there are some others, but he wants to make up for it. And so he just puts two blind people in this particular scene rather than having two different stories. Again, we can't know exactly what's going on, but we can speculate. I think probably spotlighting is a little more plausible, probable of what's going on here. So we've got other resources you can look at. RisenJesus.com is my website. If you would like to hear that debate that I had with Stephen Patterson that I mentioned at the beginning of today, unfortunately it was not video recorded, but it was audio recorded. You can go to my website, risenjesus.com, and in the search space, you know, where it has that magnifying glass, type in the name Patterson for Stephen Patterson. And that debate will come up, and you can listen to it on my website. It's about an hour and a half long. We've got other videos and articles that you can view and read on my website. There's a link to our YouTube channel. By the way, thank you so much for supporting us this year. It's been very helpful to our ministry, and great to partner with you on this. And, you know, Paul, in his letter to the church at Philippi, said that they engaged with him in the matter of giving and receiving. You know, he would teach them, and they helped supply him. And I feel like you guys have done that with us. And so it is a pleasure to come back and share with you to give. I like to give back in return to our donors. So thank you. But there you can sign up for our newsletter if you want. We have a newsletter coming out Monday, so you'll need to sign up today if you want it. So you go there and you sign up, and then you will get an email. You have to respond to that email, click a link or something like that to confirm, because we never put a person on our newsletter list unless they actually want to be on it. So, okay, let's open it up for some questions. We've got about 6-7 minutes. Yes, Mr. Cuellar. By the way, I love that last name. I was an Orioles fan growing up. I lived in Baltimore. It was during that time that we had our 420 game winners, and Mike Cuellar was one of those.
Yeah, I taught him everything he knew. So you used the phrase earlier, it means what it means, or it says what it says. And how is...
It does not mean what it says. It says what it... it does not mean what it says. It means what it means.
Do you see why I'm confused?
Yeah.
So how does one know when to take... I've heard the phrase, oh, I'm a red-letter Christian, so whatever it says in the red letters, that's exactly what Jesus said. Maybe, I don't know. How do we know when it says what... this is exactly what it is versus... it means something else.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's asked a lot. And the bottom line is, in some cases, we won't know. So, you know, when Jesus says, if your right eye makes you stumble, you know, rip it out and throw it from you. Well, does that mean what it means? Or does that mean what it says? Well, I see you still have both eyes, so you're saying no, right? You come to the book of Revelation. There in chapter 12, it talks about a great, huge, seven-headed dragon that's red, whose tail is going to sweep a third of all the stars in the universe down to the earth. Do we really think that there is a space monster flying around the cosmos who's going to do that? No. I mean, you do that with the moon, it's going to destroy the Earth, much less all the stars, which are thousands of times larger than our Earth. Just one is. He doesn't mean that in a literal sense. And in fact, it's very clear by reading a little bit further in the chapter. It's allegory for Satan, this seven-headed red dragon. So the saying, and it's on Bruce Metzger, who's a conservative New Testament scholar who died, around 2005 or 2006. He taught at Princeton. He's the one that said when it came to Revelation, a lot of times Scripture does not mean what it says. It means what it means. And sometimes we take things figuratively. Sometimes we take things literally. Of course, in Proverbs, when it talks about a woman named Wisdom standing on top of the roof, and calling out, all who are simple, come to me. We don't really take that to mean that there is a female standing on top of a roof named Wisdom that's calling out with that message. We take that as allegory, metaphor within wisdom literature, which Proverbs is. So sometimes we just don't know what it means. I mean, there's a verse in Scripture that Jesus says that I don't understand what it means when he says, You know, they're going to bring you before the authorities. They're going to beat you. They're going to scourge you and crucify you. But if you endure to the end, not a hair on your head will be harmed. Well, thanks a lot, Jesus. You're going to make ribbons out of my flesh. You're going to impale me to a cross. But as long as I hold, you're going to leave my hair alone. I don't think that's what he meant. What does he mean? I don't know. I haven't found any kind of parallel for that being some sort of an idiom of that time. So what he means, I'm not sure. So sometimes we just don't know. Sometimes we can make mistakes and think he's talking literally. I mean, there were some men in antiquity. There's a story about Origen that he took the verse literally about some made themselves, when Jesus said some made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom, and so he performed self-castration. We don't know if that story's true, but whether it is, we do know that several men in antiquity took that verse literally and castrated themselves. But that's not what Jesus meant. Can you imagine doing that and then later on someone saying, he didn't mean that in a literal sense? You know, hermeneutical blunders can have tragic consequences. All right, another question? Oh, someone else has? Yes, sir.
Something very interesting. There's been a dispute over the ages about who wrote the book of Hebrews.
Yeah.
You mentioned the language in Romans by the secretary and five different secretaries writing for Paul. To me, it almost seems like that was the mention of Paul not writing the book of Hebrews was for that reason. Do you think or do you believe that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews with another secretary that just gave it a different cut at it?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I would think that's very possible because there's a lot of what scholars would say is Pauline thought. And they think that whoever wrote Hebrews may have been heavily influenced by Paul. But I'll go back to the early 3rd century when the church father Origen wrote, "Who wrote Hebrews? In truth, only God knows." So, yeah, one more? Yes, sir.
So it doesn't mean what it says, but it means what it means. So my question is, did he say what it says?
Okay, yeah, that's fine. So that's a good question. So first of all, Jesus spoke in Aramaic most of the time, not in Greek. So what we are reading in our New Testaments, well, we're reading English translations of the Greek, which is a translation of the Aramaic, right? Not a problem, but we're not reading Jesus' exact words because he, most occasions, spoke in Aramaic and they're recorded in Greek. So that's one thing. Plus, we can see how things, the authors, we saw it last week, how they're paraphrasing. So Jesus did not necessarily say the exact or precise words, even as translated, because we see the authors changing them, paraphrasing them, right? We saw this in Jesus' baptism. Matthew changes it. The words of God, the very words that come out of heaven, Matthew felt free to change them. He maintained the gist, the meaning behind what was said, but he wasn't trying to give a transcript. That was never the objective of ancient biographers, to give a transcript, a precise transcript of what the person said on that occasion. Now, that leads to a very interesting question of which scholars are divided. They debate on these things. When we read Jesus in the Gospel of John and what he says, the message is the same, but he sounds a whole lot differently than he does in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the majority of Johannine specialists, those who have specialized in the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, Revelation, agree that what John has done is he has taken Jesus' words and he has recast them, paraphrased them, and then recast them in his own idioms, in John's own way of saying these things. So it'd be like, you know, Gary Habermas is a mentor of mine. And so I've known him for several decades. And it would be like, let's say he dies. And then which he hasn't. but let's say that he dies and someone asks me about what he taught. And so it's what I'm doing is I'm taking things that Gary might have said over the three decades or so that I've known him, and I paraphrase them, I put them together, I take them out of their context, and I rephrase them using my own words and say, this is what Gary said. So, what about some of the things that he's attributed to say in the Gospel of John? Did he say, I am the way, the truth, and the life? No one comes to the Father but by me. I think there's a good chance he did not say that. However, we read the same message he said in Matthew and Luke. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, except to whomever the Son chooses to reveal him. It's the same message, but it's entirely different words than what we find in John's gospel. But John takes that message and rewords it and casts it in his own words. And why do they think this happened? Well, there are several reasons, okay? But let me just give you one because I need to close. In the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus does not come out and make these, he's like, okay, Peter, who do you say I am? Who do you say that I am? You are the Messiah, the Son of God. Okay, don't tell anyone this. The Transfiguration, don't tell anyone about this until after the resurrection. So it's like, don't tell. He tells the demons, shut up. You know, when they say the legion, why don't torment us, you Son of God? No, hey, be quiet. You know, it's not until his time when he's before the high priest and they say, are you the Messiah, the Son of God? When Jesus says, you better believe it, bud. That's when he comes out with this. But in John, it's like, yep, I'm the Messiah. Before Abraham was, I am, clear claim to being Jehovah. And would he be doing this when elsewhere he's keeping it under wraps for a while until the appropriate time? And also in John, you have at one point the Jewish leaders say, look, if you are the Messiah, tell us plainly. And Jesus says, I have told you. It's the works that I do. They testify to who I am. So even in John, we get a glimpse that Jesus is not out there saying, I'm the Messiah. I'm the Son of God. Hey, I'm God. But that's the way it's presented in John's gospel, him out there. So as Daryl Bach, who teaches at Dallas Theological Seminary, and many other New Testament scholars have said, what John does is he recasts Jesus' words in his own idiom, John's idiom, and he makes explicit in Jesus' words what Jesus said implicitly in the other gospels. So that's how I would answer the question. Did Jesus say what is attributed to him? That is especially relevant to John's gospel. And for our 21st century Western mind, Jesus comes to us most clearly in John's gospel. We miss some things in the synoptic gospels because it's a different milieu. John's gospel is more like we do today. Thank you so much, everyone. This has been a delight. Next week, we get into some more of Plutarch and what the gospel authors do with these kinds of literary techniques. I'll remain after for a little bit if you want to ask some more questions. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for these folks who have come. This stuff is so interesting to see how the gospel authors wrote and the process and what divine inspiration allowed for. Lord, thank you, and may this encourage us. May it just drive us to love your word more and to want to seek and read it with greater understanding. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.